This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
I'm Ben Hewitt. I'm the South Australian Government Architect and I'm also the Executive Director of the Integrated Design Commission, the new design-focused group within state government at the moment. I think I just started your presentation, but no? Yeah, I'll interactivate it for you. So it is my great pleasure to be able to introduce Dr. Bert Bongers. He's the Associate Professor at the Faculty of Design, Architecture and Building at UTS. And I'm not going to do the typical bio thing because you've all got one. I first met Bert there when I started about 6 months before Bert started, and so we're very much part of a team of people who started at a similar time and all enjoyed very much working with each other and sharing ideas. And it was a real change in UTS that all of us are still quite proud of. And Bert was one of those people that was able to link between the different different schools within the faculty, which, like everything, whatever school or discipline or whatever you're in, there always seems to be this siloed approach in our contemporary society between the different things. I think Bert was one of those people that was very easily able to link across the different disciplines, link across the different types of people and really engage with us. And I was talking to my partner, who was also one of those people at UTS, who actually sort of said to me, see if you can weave this into the introduction, Bert is one of those people that you always enjoyed bumping into in the corridor because he'd always have that sort of slightly self-effacing grin on his face and the ready for a story or a conversation or go for a coffee or something like that. And I've got to say, since you've come down to Adelaide, every time you've come down to Adelaide, I think we bumped into each other on the street before we've actually met like we were supposed to do. So, look, at any rate, I think you'll hear a fantastic conversation on what interactivation is. I think Bert's really claiming that space and has done so for a number of years. So without any further comments, I'd like to introduce Bert to the stage. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Ben. Ben was one of the few people that I could talk to when I joined the Faculty of Architecture and Design. And mostly the people in the architecture school were the people that were in my field. This has changed. The design school has caught up with all things interactive, which was my my job to enable that. And when I heard that Ben was going to Adelaide, first I was devastated because I was going to miss him as a colleague, but immediately I thought that's a good reversal of the trend. You know, everyone is always from Adelaide, well, you guys obviously aren't, but you're the diehards. So please stay. It's a lovely city. My wife is from here. I often come here and always enjoy it, particularly the mushroom store in the market. It's fabulous. And a handful of other things. And I think if there are more people stop being from Adelaide and coming to Adelaide, it'll be a much better place. So thank you, Ben, for reversing the trend, and I hope more will follow. So interactivation, what kind of word is that? Looks a bit like it's a word that puts people off, because the other sessions in here were much busier, because they were about sustainability and important things. I actually have a claim on sustainability as well, because if things are easier to interact with, we would also become more efficient in our energy use and energy consumption and resource consumption. So I'm actually on a mission. That's why I call it interactivism, almost hacktivism. We do a fair bit of hacking, but at the same time, as with my background in science and engineering and my practice in design, I insist that we have to do more than hacking. We have to really understand what we're doing. So I'm teaching a lot of technology to students in order to empower them to be able to make this shit do what we want to do and not what Steve wanted us to do. He was quite right most of the time, but not always. But I'll come back to that. So for me, making things interactive, that sounds too silly to be saying out loud. So I add to that, that's a means to an end. So the goal is to have interactive things so that we can perform better, express ourselves better. I find it really difficult to express myself through digital technology, coming from a sort of analog age and acoustic guitars and other Luddite things. You know, this is my phone. Also, thinking about this is also the only slide that says anything about uncertainty, because to me that's so obvious, you know, like that other buzzword, innovation. If you don't innovate in design, you're not designing. Or user-centered design, not a pleonasm. If you don't design for users, to me that's not design. That's making, that's engineering, making things work, brilliant. We need that. But to actually make it to fit people, we need design. So it's almost equals planning for uncertainty. It's a bit unfortunate that I'm at the end of this festival. I should have said that at the beginning, then we could all have had the same festival probably. Yeah, any questions? There's a very fancy transition here. Keynote is full of transitions that are very fancy. So the slide is about stuff that happens in my studio. The image on the right is at the opening of the studio in 2008. And the other slide is from last week, when I had a bunch of master students in playing, tinkering with electronics and trying to electrocute themselves. It's very similar to the Bright Sparks lab in the small room over there. So if you like this, just leave, go to that room and play with the electronics there. There are a few slides coming up in which I want to comment on what other people have said. For instance, that what Jeff Jones said yesterday. Is Jeff here? Before I be rude about him. Anyway, I like this talk very much, but his definition of interaction is something between people. I agree with that, but I want to join that with the technology. It's not a separate thing, right? I'm trying to merge technology and nature, and that's our environment. So for me, interaction is about all this. And so it's how people and technology interact. And that field is not just about psychologists and computer scientists disagreeing with each other. This is what happens for decades in HCI conferences that I've been going to. But there's a whole bunch of human sciences that are important for this research field, and a whole bunch of technical sciences. Don't need to study them all in order to become a good interactivist, but it does help. So my own background is all over that circle. But it's still only scratching the surface, of course. The design disciplines traditionally always have had a firm go at interface design and how to design our environment from the intimate to the spatial so that we can actually interact with it. And then I had another drink and I thought maybe we should add as a sort of meta-disciplines art, philosophy, and mathematics around it. And I'm going to move on because this is a slide that you can probably criticize or add to or discuss about for the next hour, and we have 200 more slides to get through. So this is another comment on the speaker from the CSIRO yesterday in here. I forgot his name. I met him before. He was very funny. But he posed a question to the audience. I don't know who was here. Of whether a surfboard is technology. And I think about 93% of the audience thought it was technology. And he was one of the odd ones who thought it wasn't, like a piano. And so so this is technology, right? This was my final project in my engineering degree in 1912 or something. it was digital, so it must have been a bit later. So what I've done is categorizing technologies. So this is digital interactive technology, and this is mechanical object technology. And the first picture of that was from the British Museum in London, and this is much closer to home because in Australia you have the privilege of living next door or on top of a culture that was largely in the Stone Age or in the Wood Age. Read a lot about that, went to the beautiful exhibition in the Australian Museum, South Australian Museum. And I learn a lot from Aboriginal culture and approaches to the environment and attitudes to the landscape and storytelling and a symbolism. But, you know, trying to stick to my more scientific roots, I read things like this. Well, this is a bit jovial, isn't it? The Singing Neanderthals. Anybody know this book? It's very readable. Stephen Mithen is a professor at, I think, the University of Reading, and he became famous for writing a book about prehistoric cognition, and that's something that you cannot study because those brains don't exist anymore. And he's allowed to do that because it's my son. Rufus is sort of climbing down. That's what's happening. Mithen has, it's all about the origins of language and how that's rooted in music and was much more a holistic language rather than an atomic language, how we have it now. And I find it very interesting to study not only the history of technology, but the history of communication and artifacts and how we've developed ourselves by externalizing our thoughts. And I think there's still actually a massive leap possible. So that's way beyond Steve, what I'm talking about, what I'm hoping for and aiming to contribute to. One of Mithen's interesting theories was about, he looked at prehistoric hand axes, and they've been around for some point unchanged in design for about 2 million years. And he relates that to brain development and how that stagnated, probably because of the lack of development in the tools. But I tell my industrial design students this because a product that has been around for two million years, that's a good benchmark for them. And he also wonders why there are so many hand axes beautifully chipped and really beautifully made. So he proposes that the makers of those artifacts did that to impress the ladies. But he calls it a sexy hand axe theory. But as a side note, he admits that we actually don't know if it was the men or the women who made the tools. Lewis Mumford would say it's the men because they're weapons, and it was always about killing and breaking things, whereas the women, when agriculture came along and the first villages and then cities emerged, that was all based on containing, keeping things and looking after things, and roundness rather than square and sharp. I like that because I try to make technology less hard-edged and softer, sort of sissy geek. And then to go back to a friend from the CSRO, so this would be technology, right? The Röntgen machine of Dr. William Bragg. He would be called Billy Bragg, I think, nowadays, play the guitar. In my environment, I see a lot of crap. High tech, low tech, it's incredible. There's a bit of Dutch for Bart. So the handles say pull, but one of them actually says push. So that's a conflict of labels, if you like. And Ben and I went for a very nice meal in the museum cafe here. And I see these things everywhere. So if you want to get out, you have to push the red button. Yeah, red is panic. Get out of here. Emergency. And they're the buttons. I think the fire brigade comes if you press one of these. But on the plane, I read this thing. I think it was a joke, actually, that you can start your car with an iPhone app. I haven't tried. Anyone tried this? Go for it. There's a category of absolutely useless technologies. And a lot of what we think that Steve has invented for us goes there. So, and this toaster, it's actually on my CD player. I have an eject button on the remote control, and it's about its most useless feature. And it's prominently on the top right-hand corner, very easy to reach, so you can always eject your CD from a distance and then get a gnome or something to take it out. There's another button, probably 10 plus. And as a side note, I love this CD player. That's why I bought it. Nice wood. I took it apart. It's actually MDF, and it's all plastic and metal inside. it's very clumsy in its interaction. If you pause it and then say, okay, go back to the beginning of the track and play again, it doesn't do that. And a whole bunch of other things. It doesn't want to change the volume or the tracks if it's still loading the CD, because it's busy. So if you go to an office and you have to fill in forms, that's what technology seems to emulate. And then you get real toasters emulating computer technology. So now you can eject. And that's already a good one compared to the ones that say cancel. What kind of language is that? Ask people who make, what's that, Fisher and Paykel, I think. This is a cooker with an interface from hell. You have to press buttons 16 times to get up. And yeah, maybe, sorry if you have one, but I find this almost impossible to use. And that little dot behind the 9, that means that it's, that you can change it. And I think H means that it's hot. So it's hot there. Don't burn yourself. And it tells you here, right? I managed to cook all right. This was in a holiday home. But, and, of course, computers. Try this. It's hexadecimal. That's why it has the letters in it. Shall I tell you all about hexadecimal arithmetic? Get out of here. So, this is called tweeting, in case you're... To a Dutchman, the term hashtag means something very different. Some local examples. So I got into the lift yesterday with a pram and trying to get out. And the manual is on the other side, so you can read it, the manual. Or Braille. But Braille probably, it will still say M, which is mezzanine, of course. And G, ground floor, B, base, E, entrance or exit, depending on where you come from. Or Erdgeschoss in German, and that's the basement. So, all right, I can do it. Or this bin, I just discovered this waiting out there. This is called techno stress. Yeah. You know those bins that you push on the top and they open with a mechanical thing? Well, we can do better. We can put electronics in there and then have a sensor that if you walk past, it opens automatically. And sort of give me litter. We've got a land to fill. I nearly put my camera in. Did you see that? That's how tempting it was. That's like the doors that you walk past and they open up. I'm being cheeky here because these ones actually have a radar sensor which can detect direction of movement. But there's good news too. Last time I came to Adelaide in June, I was welcomed at the airport by an electric vehicle. And then in the Adelaide market, there was a charging station for it. So you're on. Okay, any questions so far? Let's talk about Steve, because Philip Adams can't leave it alone. And this is a sensitive topic, of course, because he's done a lot of good things. I'm here presenting with an Apple. Doesn't make me an Apple fan. I have a lot of trouble with Apples. I think there's a lot of things not done so well. But to me, coming from a technical background, worked with all platforms, Unix, Windows, Atari, Apple is by far the best, but not good enough. So this is like living in a world where you can go to the car shop and you can buy, the T-Ford, any color, as long as it's black. So we got two cars in the showroom. And where's the Maserati, for instance? I think Apple is actually not even a Porsche. In the land of Windows, Apple is Porsche, yes. But Microsoft is getting better too. So one thing that you can learn from Steve, I think, is that that competitors with the success of the iPhone copy its looks, and that's so lame and so obviously not what Steve intended. What is good about the iPhone, I don't know what you think. I could ask you who's got one. I got an iPod Touch to pretend that I've got an iPhone. For Rufus, everything is a phone now. And this is my phone. Piece of crap. I might buy an iPhone at some point, just because then I have a small computer with me. But as a phone, it's ridiculous, of course. all its other functions, so they improve the interface. That's the big breakthrough for me. I'm the interaction person, so to the man with the hammer, the whole world looks like a nail, and to the man to the interactivist, the whole world looks like an interface problem. But I did think that there's a problem with copying what things look like. I don't understand how a whole industry can miss the point so profoundly. So we want something better than the iPhone. If Steve can do it, anyone can do it. And the way he did that in Apple was not just make the iMac look cute, although that was a great achievement, but actually going, that's what I'm trying to do, to really deep into the technology in order to shape it to meet the humans. So this is the previous model of the PowerBook, but you can already see that all the ports are neatly on the side and not on the back. And try to do that in a computer company. So here's HP, I think. And still, PCs, laptops have the plugs all over the place, just where they end up for the engineer to be easy. And thanks to Steve, he pushed the engineers to make the ports where you want them to be. And it's not trivial, because it's not just a port. Behind it is a piece of very complicated electronics that preferably wants to be there. So it influences the whole design. Integrated design commission, small scale in the computer. It's pretty crazy. And then the next version is this one that has all the connections on one side. And then I think they went too far, because sometimes I want a USB connection on the right-hand side. That's where my mouse wants to be. And Apple sells mouse with a very short cable. So the left and the right hand, the left and the right brain, haven't communicated very well in that company. And, of course, silly things like it's beautiful that this glows, but it means that if you're against bright light, it works the other way. Another example, technical. So the bright sparks will tell you that if you put two batteries, 1.5 volts together, you get 3 volts, and then you can turn it into a torch or a remote control. Ooh, look. So what happens is they put them opposite ways. I think we're quite used to that now, because that means that at this end, all you need is a bit of metal connecting the two batteries, and out here you get your 3 volts going into your circuit. So it saves a bit of wiring and a bit of hassle on the design of the technology. But it doesn't make sense to anyone, or didn't when it was first introduced. So I think all of us, at one point or another, we've put the batteries in the wrong way. And Apple's is another example of Steve's legacy. Okay, well, let's put them straight. It's not that much harder to design, and they've done it. It looks like that inside. But then I find that's actually confusing, because we're so used to this that this doesn't make sense. And we do that all the time. Idiots we are. We adapt to technology to the extreme. Or we say, oh, it's too complicated. Those young people, they get it. And that's a myth. When I talk to students, they know fuck all about technology. It's not true. They use Facebook, and they have Google read all their emails, buy into the advertising companies that they are. And of course, Lunik can comment on that much more profound. Okay. I have to hurry up a bit, because I haven't even started yet. So this was, when I thought about this talk, I was actually going to call it anthropomorphic resonances, but I thought that'd be too wacky, so I called it interactivation. And maybe if I called it anthropomorphic resonances, there would have been more people in the room, or less, you don't know. I wrote a whole paper about this, and I realized that you don't not just want to resonate, but also you need, sometimes you need that hard edge, because that's information in there. So if everything is just easy, it's not always so easy. So I will show some examples of where I come from and why I think the way that I do. So first of all, during my engineering degree, I got in touch with these sort of people that wanted to make music with computers, and realized that the mouse and the keyboard is not just a little bit too limited, but just completely inhibiting any musical thought. So, got to work with a whole bunch of people developing interfaces that were musical and expressive. So they were very, it's like having a handful of analog controllers, putting the analog back into the digital in a way. So the glove, for instance, of Leticia Tsunami has about 25 analog sensors in one hand. And if you count the degrees of freedom of your hand, that's also about 25. And if you count the degrees of freedom of a mouse, 2. That's an insult to the hand. That's why Michel Weisfried called his instrument the hands. And you can see this is not designed, this is just evolved with the people in the workshop building the instruments. And I got in there in 87 and built a new version for him. A very inspiring musician made this web thing to get more analog control, basically. So you grab the thing and all the parts of the web are sensors and sense continuously what you're doing. And I was trying to go back to this crackle box, which this is a small version, but Michel used to play in the 70s with improvised jazz bands with a crackle synthesizer with analog electronics. So you put your fingers inside the circuit, and if you're not careful, you electrocute yourself, but you can actually become part of the circuit and influence it with your body. So that's about the most sensitive electronic musical instrument that you can think of. And when we went to digital, that was really hard to emulate that, but not impossible. So CAI is the main human-computer interaction conference, and you get 2,000 people together, usually in America, talking about how to make better interfaces. And in 2005, Michel was the keynote performer to close the conference. And he played his hands there and made a very strong statement, I felt, to the community of, look what an expressive interface could be like. Whether you agree with his music or not is a different thing. He also brought 30 crackle boxes and handed them out to the student volunteers, which suddenly became a very desirable job. Lots of students wanted to become, because they were able to keep the crackle box afterwards. And he had them, on the left is the practice run, and on the right is what happened during at the end of his performance. He got everyone with their crackle boxes to come up and walk towards the stage. So all those different crackle sounds coming up to the stage. And you see Michel as a sort of proud daddy looking after all those kids doing funky things. And the chairman of the conference was Gerrit van der Veer, who was my professor in Amsterdam, where I did my PhD. And so these are sort of my grandfathers of about thinking. Michel unfortunately died in 2008 of cancer. And so this, you see, I hope it's clear, there's a lot of analogy with Steve Jobs and Michel. And when he died, I made a plea to myself that what I should do is not copy his instrument, of course, but try even harder to make computers sensitive as he did with musical things. So one of the things that you can try for yourself is my kaleidoscopic projection over there. And that's one of my attempts to make a statement about that the computer can be really sensitive to the movements that I make. Well, my other big source of inspiration has been architecture. Since 1997, I've been working with these Dutch architects making interfaces and interactive parts for their buildings. And that's a great learning experience. Cas Oosterhuis particularly, he's a professor in Delft as a part-time, as well as leading his very famous ONL practice. He's pretty insane. He wants the building to be actually moving. So not liquid architecture as in suggesting a movement, like for instance Zaha Hadid or Greg Lynn would do, but actually make them move. So in this time, about 5 years ago, we worked with pneumatic muscles creating kinetic structures. So from the parametric architecture that's behind it and can be changed in real time, you have a real-time parametric one-to-one scale building. And again, my part was to provide the input from the people so you could approach it and touch it or stay away, and the beast would know that. And with them, I did. I'm still involved in this project where we develop interfaces for a multi-user design environment. Like Jeff Jones said the other day, if you have a big team of different disciplines in one room, they all have to have different roles in the design process. So we try to match that with giving everyone access to different tools for different functions. So rather than doing everything with a mouse or everything with a game controller, which was one of their preferred methods, we looked at different ways of manipulating the parametric design. I'm going to jump back a bit because I want to talk a little bit about interactive video stuff, which started with a video instrument for live performance. There's sound with this too. So we made an audio-visual instrument, if you like. And again, a bit like the Delft project later, I explored this notion of having a modular interface. So every effect has its own interface, which is a radical break with what the normal computer paradigm is. You have one interface, and that maps onto everything. And obviously, that can never be optimal. So if you take a bit more time, then you can design the elements of the interface that would respond to that need. Then I had a habit of, because that's very easy to do in Keynote, putting videos like this and just to mesmerize you. I've tried this in PowerPoint, and it's not possible in PowerPoint unless you edit your videos beforehand. So that's a good example of how, because there's lots of crap in Keynote, but there are a few good things. So it enabled me to come up with this trick thanks to the tool. So thank you, Steve. I was inspired by this quarter kind of veneer technique, or that you see in buildings, and started to build installations with, like the one in the corridor here, that are kaleidoscopic, based on the principle of mirroring and then zooming. So for the opening of my studio in 2008, I put up several projections on the courtyard and on the building next door, and heaps of fun. We can't do this anymore because there's another building put in front of it, so we lost our big projection screen. Meanwhile, so indoor, in my studio, the interactive agent studio, I always try to be very open to people coming in and exploring what we're doing. So it's something that nowadays it's often called a living lab. I think a lab that's not living would be a dead lab, and who would want that? But anyway, so we're quite in a public spot with glass walls opening up to the courtyard where the cafe is. And these are two colleagues of mine, Sam Spur, and Ben knows her well, who is senior lecturer in interior design and the head of that course, and Leon Loke, who is from the IT faculty. And they're both dancers, as you can see. So I had this setup where I started to manipulate in real time. So it's not Keynote anymore then. The image is in real time with furniture. And I've got the best wallpaper on the block. I also discovered that if you point the camera at the image and then manipulate it with the sensors, you get very wacky things. So sort of free images. Video feedback is cool. So that's sort of visual Jimi Hendrix. And again, I don't know, in this case, I don't know who these ladies are. They walked in one evening when I was making this. They were curious and sat down on the sensor chair and played for half an hour. And I took the liberty of filming that because what they show me is things they discover in that installation that I hadn't designed, if you like. So with this whole work, what I'm trying to do is to give it over to people. So the patterns that it generates are I don't feel I own them. I facilitate it. And so this was a big scale one. Well, compared to our brutalist UDS tower, it's still quite small, but putting the sensors in the furniture and into wooden blocks that people can manipulate. And these are the blocks that I brought with me. So in the corner there, you can play with the projection on the wall in the corridor and test my statements. Is it true what he's saying? And I chose to have a semi-transparent screen so you can focus on the image or focus on the world behind it. Because I aim generally with my work to link nature and technology. You know, that's why I've got a ponytail and all that. The human eyes, or human perception rather, is very good at doing that. And then this is what it looked like. And it was, I think, also the first time that Anya said something nice about my work. So you can see that the patterns that are generated come from the movement of the people. So I insist that it's theirs. I should. Then I thought, well, that's all jolly nice, but it's too square, so let's make circles. So we were invited by the Powerhouse Museum. They had an evening event as part of Sydney Design in 2009. It was a very busy year. So we put five projections, circular projections on the ceiling, and every projection was controlled by a separate set of sensors. So we had the wooden blocks and a balance board and a new jacket designed by Donna Scrow. That's a sensor jacket, wireless sensor jacket. And one of the master students here got to be the guinea pig for that. And what was interesting about that is that she didn't know what it was doing, so she had to explore. So she's trying out all sorts of movements, some of which that I know were sensed and tracked, and others that weren't. And my idea then is not to say when she makes a movement that's not tracked, to say that she's doing something wrong, but that is an opportunity for us to design for that. And then when we came back, I put it on the floor. So that's the facets pool that we can wallow in. And I left it on. It's been on for nearly 2 years now. In later this month, I'm going to bring it to the Carriage Works, where there's an expanded architecture festival, and I want to project it on the floor. This is what I hope it looks like. Now, this is funny for me. This is the first time I made a mock-up, so this is not real. And it felt really weird to do something normal, I suppose. Just to show that I do sort of semi-serious things as well, we made a reading table with RFID sensors in the table and RFID tags in the books. And that way I could link multimedia content, like videos or websites, to an object, in this case a book. So you would pick up a book and say, oh, I wonder what that would look like. The object becomes the interface to the media. How are we doing for time? Oh. Okay.
Want some time for questions?
Yes, I do. So I'm going too fast, because this is a project that makes me look like an idiot anyway. I was very, coming to Australia, particularly certain areas. This is in York Peninsula, and this is in Wollongong. I got fascinated by these skid marks, because there's not enough room in the Netherlands to do such things. So I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then I found that sometimes they're really nice patterns, and I read them as music. Maybe that's the weird thing. So I started filming them and putting them in this funny pattern. And here's another one. And turning them into sound. So I'm trying to follow the lines with my setup. Well, and because Steve Vai wasn't available, I thought I'd do it myself. I'm not a great guitar player, but one of the reasons why I'm interested in expressive instruments comes from this knowledge of traditional musical instruments. And I thought, why is there such a mismatch? So I used my electric guitar feedbacking the sound using an e-bow that vibrates the string continuously, and a slide, and a whammy pedal that can change the pitch so I could follow two lines at the same time with two different glissandi, and recorded all that and put it like this in the gallery at the faculty on two screens. Now, before I show that, I have to show you the other part of the exhibition, which was this, again to a Dutchman. That is fascinating. This doesn't happen in the Netherlands. Occasionally you see a little bit of builder graffiti, but generally I think you go to jail if you paint on the floor in the Netherlands. So I filmed that and photographed it for years. I was very fascinated by the... Sometimes some of these patterns are really beautiful. So I thought if you stick them up in the gallery, it's art, right? Free. But also I want to make a statement with this installation, was to say, particularly to students, open up your eyes and be more aware. Look down, look up, look at what you see in your environment, and what can you learn from that about people's behaviors, and how can that influence your design? You're not just going to ask people what they want and then design it for them, because people often don't know. So you have to really thoroughly study their behaviors, not only through interviews and observations, but also through the traces that they leave. And then after having said that, you pose in front of your installation. And then I did something really dangerous for the opening. I thought I'm going to perform these skid marks live. And after a few beers, I was okay with it. And then for the closing event, I just can't stop. I thought it'd be nice to extend the gallery into my studio because they're next door. So we made, I had some more work up my sleeve that was not in the gallery, and then put it in there. Yeah, I'm about halfway. Now look, here's another thing. Saab doesn't just make weapon systems, they also make cars. So a couple of years ago I started using GPS to make tracings rather than find traces. So this is me posing on the ferry, trying to make these sort of... I was thinking, and I'm not the only one, people have done this a lot already, looking at how you can use GPS as a way of drawing. So these are my first experiments. And it's actually quite crazy to be on the boat and then seeing your line disappear. You're all used to that with your navigation systems in the car, but they cheat because they pull you onto the map. It's their knowledge of the map that makes it accurate. And on the water, you don't have that. So this is like going over the bridge, and I can tell you the boat did not do that. And you may think that I'm a bit dumb, but you actually, when you make this line, you look up, is there an ocean cruiser there? Because it's on Google, right? It must be true. Our house had also the old car in front of it. So don't believe Google. And then something wacky happened one day when I was coming in with this. The GPS lost track. So I went into the train underground, and it took me... It thought I was suddenly in Africa. And so here's a bit of Eames' quote of the powers of 10 backwards. Then coming here, and that's why I didn't want to skip this, I thought it must be possible to do this on the plane. And again, I look out of the window and I don't see this landscape. I see clouds. It's just not true. But you can see the values of the GPS. Sorry. They make sense. We're going about 1,200 meters high, and we're going about 700 kilometers an hour. And when I got onto the ground, that's the limit of the buffer. So you go in steps. Then suddenly you realize that with this, I can't actually draw in a plane because the plane goes too fast. And that's what it looked like. This is work in progress. So if you want to ask me questions, maybe not this. Yeah, because then it starts eating its tail. I've got another technique to capture the trace, and that's more detailed. Because I also want to capture all the information about the satellites and turn that into sound or an image. Probably an image. Maybe if I keep my finger on the fast forward. That was portable projections, and that was a firm statement to get out of the frame. But I realized we always frame our videos, and I thought it would be nice to bring it out there or onto the water or on Cockatoo Island. So these are not mock-ups. This is real. And eventually they turned off the beautiful east-facing wall, put off the light so I could project on it. But you have to believe me. And then took it into a laneway and got people to play with it. But it still looks like a projector, and people are very hesitant picking up a projector. There's some intimidation going on with technology, and that's what I'm trying to break through. Of course, taggers have no fear, and they have no frame. So these are some pictures from last time I was in Adelaide, and you see this one. Probably recognize this is all over town. I don't know who he is or she is. Got some company from other people now. Here's another one near Maria around the corner. Got painted over. But Stephen is going to solve that for us. Yay. So it's sort of government sponsored. And even part of the festival. And then it gets into the gallery. Isn't that funny? I've got great appreciation for this work. I want to know who did it and how they managed to design so well. It's one thing to get out of the frame, but then how do you design for such a screen? And I think this surpasses the work of the Relatives United in Berlin at the Alexanderplatz, which used to be the benchmark. So I think here in Adelaide you've got a new benchmark. If you're in Sydney, then go to the Lovelace exhibition. I really want to show you this because I worked really hard last night getting these videos in place. So what we did was use lace and embed sensors in it and project an image on it and then get on television with it. So using the lace as a projection material and as an interface at the same time and get Rufus to pose in it, get it in the newspaper. That's Cecilia who did the lace. And she's doing more stuff. And then I'm extending her lace with video feedback. And this is a serious project, but you have to read the paper about that. That is for rehabilitation. So nowadays, my colleague Stuart Smith, who I work with, is using video games and we're using musical feedback to make rehabilitation more interesting, and the electronics that we have can facilitate this sort of stuff. And working with design students who create better shapes for the patients to hold. I think that's another cheesy picture presented at a conference. And eventually we actually brought it back to the patients and found out that the students had not done such a great job. And to round off, I'm skipping 12 slides here, advertisement for our new Masters of Design at the Design School. I'm running one of the majors, so if you want to do a Master in Interactivation, come and play. And if you're researching things yourself and you want to present it in a workshop, this is a workshop I'm organizing in Canberra at the end of November. And I'm doing that to bring people together to look at, say, human-computer interaction on the landscape scale. That was the topic of my sabbatical of last semester. And I summarized that in one sentence. Good, huh? I'm also the last session, so we can go on till the cows come home.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Is there a burning question? I've got a couple of burning questions, but it's we have an audience here with questions, I'm assuming.
But in the introduction that you gave, this device that you have, the computer, the frustrates the hell out of me that keyboards and the 2 degree of freedom mouse.
Yeah.
Is really quite a limitation. Where's it going? How do you see this being a better tool for us into the future?
I think it's more physical objects. So I think multi-touch, what Apple has brought to the masses, is really good, very important. I think Microsoft is doing their part with the movement-based interaction, but they actually get on the wrong try to put us all on the wrong foot, as they always do, by telling that we don't need a controller because the body is the controller. And coming from this musical background where people have tried to make music by movement, we know that it's really hard to be accurate like that or articulate. And so you do need the feedback from the physical objects. So I think we'll see more physical objects, and that is actually a tendency in my field. There's a recent conference started on that, on tangible interaction, and they all talk about physical stuff. It was like coming home to when I went to that conference, like, yay, I'm not the only one anymore. And then the other thing that I think that will add to it eventually is more emphasis on say, the active form. Because now an object is an object, it's static, and maybe it might vibrate, but it can't change shape in real time. And technically, there's a lot of things possible with that. And then you get, the flexibility of the image merged with the flexibility of an object. That's what I want to see during my lifetime. And space travel can wait. He's going to say haptics. That's the official term for it. Haptic feedback.
Do you think the haptic technology is going to change some of that, like the interactive form, since you've got a lot of scope for that, that type of thing?
Yeah, I'm hoping for a breakthrough like what interactive graphics have done. Only a few decades ago that started to, because the first computer interfaces were text-based, and then they became visual, and now they have to become physical. Your haptic perception is your sense of motion and your sense of touch combined, of you doing manipulating things, all the feedback that you get.
Yes, incredibly interesting. You started out with the fist X, and here we have the computer. Now, and you emphasize more and more this physical interaction and this physical object. So do you see, let's say, the computer as a classical tool that you can actually control? Because there's also an aspect about the computer, which is the whole network behind it, and is fed by, the meantime, millions of people, and that seems to have a life of its own. So to what degree is it really important to control it? And to what degree would it be interesting to discover things in this network?
Yeah, I think it's out of balance that Alan Kay, one of the people who worked on the graphical user interface as we know it, he always said that the computer is both a tool and a medium. And then because of the networking and the internet, the computer has become a mega medium in a way. And to me, it seems odd that the interface hasn't kept up to that, with that as a tool, if you like. Because when the mouse and that whole point and click interaction paradigm was invented in the early 70s, that was the technology of that time. They could just about do that. And with the current technology, and I've been saying this actually for 10 years, so I'm getting a bit bored with myself, but it's getting more and more true that the technology is so much more powerful. And why is the interface not keeping up with it? Again, the multi-touch of Apple is a slight improvement. I think that's good. But I want to see what happens. When I talk to people who do 3D modeling, CAD, designing shapes in the computer, they always tell me how difficult it is, how many weird keyboard shortcuts they have to memorize to change that spline or change that parameter in their program. So the project in Delft was an attempt to have a complex piece of design software, parametric design software, and map that to new types of interfaces. And I think that when we get a better match, you get much better outcome of your design tools. That's what we're doing it for.
I'm really interested in what you're saying about the interface, because what really fascinates me is with the new iPhones and iPads, the way they've got three-dimensional accelerometers and gyroscopes in them, as well as GPS for positioning. Surely you've got this, you've just increased the number of dimensions rather than just a mouse and squeezing and pinching. You've now got a tremendous number of potential ways of inputting information. So I think the hardware designers have now supplied the software engineers and the thinkers with another kind of half a dozen ways of inputting information. What are your thoughts?
That's what I'm using. The blocks that I use for the kaleidoscope installation uses accelerometers. And I don't know what took them so long, but accelerometers have only recently become affordable. Like 15 years ago, I developed one for musical purposes, and that was a low-cost one, meant below $1,000. And I found one for $150, designed a circuit around it so that musicians could use them. And a couple of years later, Analog Devices and other companies started to bring out, partially because of the airbag, so the sensor that sets off the airbag is an accelerometer. So because of other tendencies in industries, the sensors became cheaper and more affordable. And now they're like dirt cheap. And you can buy a whole circuit for $40 that plugs straight into your computer. Or you get your iPhone. I'm actually using the iPod Touch not so much as a music player, but as an interface. So I use the touch screen and the motion sensors to control the computer. But I'm a bit worried about everything getting into the phone, because then it's not a phone anymore, right? So to me, it's more an interface. So I wonder if I've always thought that or predicted that instead of having a telephone with everything crammed in to make things even worse than with your computer, that you would get a personal interface that's an object that's yours, and you carry it around and you can control your computer or your environment or maybe even turn on your car. And then, hey presto, what's happening is that the Apple iPhone is becoming that interface. I think it doesn't need to be a phone for me. Maybe that's the problem.
Okay. So thank you very much for the questions. And Bert, thank you for your presentation. I was really intrigued, and maybe it's a funny place to sum up your talk about, but it was this idea that maybe you're not asking people what it is that they want in order to start a process of human-centered design. Mm. And there's an interesting contradiction in that, which I think points to that quite open experimental approach you have to both taking found objects and the things that we use and understanding how they might be used to reconfiguring them in very subtle ways. And I think about that chair that Sam and Leanne were manipulating. They didn't know how the chair worked.
But they worked it out.
But they were uncovering it, and your sort of willingness to allow people to uncover through that process and then fold that back into your own work. I think it's a very interesting way of being in the world and like, to my mind, actually truly experimenting in particular ways, actually being very open to what might be.
Yeah, I think you want to give people open tools rather than closed things like, we think you want this, and here's the tool that gets you there. Yeah. And if we got it wrong, and software designers quite consistently, I mean, inevitably get it wrong, so they get you to the point where they think you want it to be, and it's not where I want it to be. Yeah. So give people more control of their own, to design their own environment. So they design with us rather than we for them. Yeah. But we might propose things occasionally. Yeah. You could just go like, I think this is a cool thing. What do you think?
A great place to end. Thank you, Bill.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.